Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Brazilian simply has to score himself, and Brazil win the World Cup. So the pendulum has swung wildly against Italy now.
Roberto Baggio, the saviour of Italy throughout this tournament. He's missed it, and Brazil win the World Cup. Baggio stays rooted to the spot.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Political Football, the World Cup series, from These Football Times. After four series looking around the world and back through time to examine how football and politics seem to be inevitably and inextricably knitted together as part of the social fabric of life, we decided to take a different tack in Series 5. We're looking at World Cup tournaments up to and including the scheduled 2022 event in Qatar. In the company of a number of typically brilliant and knowledgeable guests, we're looking at in depth at each tournament, considering the wider political situation at the time, how and why politics were involved in the awarding of the tournament, and any issues regarding location. Plus, of course, the movers and shakers at the heart of these things. With regard to the tournament in particular, we'll also look at the political aspects involving players, teams, managers, and any key rivalries. We've been writing through the tournaments, and we're now up to 1994, the time when the World Cup visited the USA. As ever, sitting in the co-host seat, alongside me is my political football compadre, Stu Horsfield. Hiya, mate.
Hi, Gary, you OK?
I'm good, thank you. I just realised I always say, how you doing, Stu? So I was consciously trying not to say, how you doing, Stu?
That's all right, don't worry. To be fair, however you call me, I'm usually doing about the same. I don't think it makes much difference. But yeah, looking forward to this one. It's probably a World Cup that I know the least about. Probably, I don't mean I have the least interest in it, but I was away from home when this World Cup was on. I was around Europe. I was young, backpacking, didn't see a lot. Caught the odd game, highlights the odd games in many different languages that I couldn't understand. I was back home for the final, but. With England not qualifying, it seemed like the best summer to go, I guess. It's a World Cup that I've probably had the least amount of involvement. Obviously, as a fan of football, you know, when it comes to the World Cup summers, you sort of sat in front of the television taking as much in as possible. Whereas this one was literally just, you know, snippets here and there, and that was it. So very, very keen to learn tonight, especially with regards to the political inferences as well.
Yeah, you know what we could do with? We could do with a guy coming on as guest who really knows about the USA and football, and perhaps even somebody who's written a book about it.
Well,
what a chance do you think, mate?
I'll tell you what, only because you said, how are you doing, Stu? Only because you changed up the intro this evening. I've got a guest for you tonight, Mr. Tom Scholes. Tom contributes to These Football Times, social media producer for the UK radio station Talk Sport, and, as you so wished, Gary, author of the book Stateside Soccer, The Definitive History of Soccer in the United States. That was as near as I could get to it for you on a book on football in America. Obviously, a while ago, Tom did speak to us on one of our Centre Circle podcasts as well, so he knows how we work, he knows how these things operate. So in terms of what you were wishing for, I feel like the genie in Aladdin's lamp. Whatever you've rubbed and wished for, I've provided it for you tonight.
Okay, I'm not going to rub you a lot, mate, but I'll take your word for it. How you doing, Tom?
I'm all right, thank you. I am a bit taken aback by you've used one of your three wishes on me. If I'm honest, feels like a bit of a waste. But if you insist, I'm feeling good. I'm excited to talk about what I'd say is an important World Cup, and a World Cup that most people probably don't remember too much about, but in a way, you know, that makes it even more interesting. Yeah, very much looking forward to this. Very much looking forward to talking about some actual football and not hypothetical football. But no, I'm looking forward to it very much. Right. So.
Right, let's get the ball out and have a kick about them, matey. So, why this tournament, Tom? What particularly interests you about the politics of this one over and above the other World Cup tournaments?
Well, as I just said then, I feel like this World Cup in particular is quite an important one, because while it wasn't, you know, we spoke about this off air just before coming on, this wasn't the first commercialised World Cup, not by any stretch of the imagination. You'd probably say 1970 was the first one where FIFA realised they could make money from advertising hoardings, but this is probably the first Disney-fied World Cup, I think you'd probably say, because You could contrast the look and the feel of USA 94 to Italia 90. They're almost two. You wouldn't even think they were the same tournament. So the football in the world had changed so much within those 4 years that it had gone from, you know, certainly, I'd probably say, even in a football sense within this country, it had gone from Italia 90, you know, oh, we're just about getting out of it, you know, maybe this is the start of something new, to by the time USA 94 came around, obviously, you know, as you said, England did not qualify for this tournament, but you look at what happened, you know, in the world at the time, and, you know, music in England and Britain, such as like Oasis and Blur, were coming out. They were going head to head with each other. It was just after the peak of the Stone Roses, so that whole scene was massive as well. It was a completely different feel politically, because you had, you know, Bill Clinton was kicking about over in the United States, and he was a complete opposite to George Bush Senior, who, you know, represented a rather older, more vintage time, I suppose you could say, or retro time. And then over here you had New Labour, which was looking to do something completely different. It was on the verge of coming up, and as we've seen, you know, a lot of people like Labour, which is, you know, that's their thing. But at the time, you know, people can look back at it now with hindsight, well, literally with 2020 vision in 2020, they can look back and kind of go, oh, maybe, you know, maybe this bit or maybe that bit was a little bit iffy. But at the time, it felt new, it felt fresh, it felt different. And that's kind of, you know, not without being too kind of purposely trying to tie something in with another. But I felt like the world at the time felt new, it felt like it was coming into a new era, it was a bit more colourful, it was a bit more bright, people were a bit more optimistic, and I felt this World Cup kind of symbolises that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess World Cup tournaments are, for people, are a lot like milestones in their lives, and it seems from what you're saying that this might be one for you. Is that fair?
Well, not personally, because I wasn't born. But,
oh.
But in the kind of like hype, in the like the look back and looking through the rear view mirror and understanding how the world works, I think it was a big one. Personally, for me, even though I was born in 97, I'll show my age. I was born in 97, so technically the first World Cup I was around for was France 98. I wasn't even one. So I didn't really have much of a clue what was going on there. I certainly couldn't look at the World Cup final and go, God, Ronaldo looks out of sorts at 18 months or however old I've been. World Cup 2002, I was around, I was more aware of it, but I wasn't too interested as such. So I suppose, like you were saying, the milestones for people, mine was the World Cup 2006, which has the same similar feel in a sense, because you go back and look at that one, it was colourful, it was bright, it was new, it was in new stadiums, it was a new feel, it was new everything like that. And I feel USA 94 has a similar feel to it, because you go back and look at that one and like we said, compare it to other ones. Every game, seemingly every game, it was sunny. Yep. It was ram-packed. It was to capacity. It was everything like that. I think, whilst it personally wasn't a milestone for me, I think for football and for sports and for culture, it was a milestone, because it ended up, whilst it isn't probably loved as much as Italia 90 for obvious reasons, and, well, certainly speaking from this country, you know, Italia 90 is getting the same treatment as the 2018 World Cup is getting, because even though England didn't go and win the tournament, it still grasped the nation, everything like that. I think the same happened for USA 94, but for other countries, you know, mainly Ireland, which I'll talk about in a bit more detail later on, and nations like Ireland and Bulgaria and Romania, places that didn't really, you know, have anything to look forward to prior to this, but to them, this is their Italia 90, so to speak.
Yeah, fair comments. I mean, I remember it being very the heat of the games, and I remember players being sort of carried bags of water, little plastic bags, which was very weird, and Jack Charlton looking very like to keel over and go red in the face. Yes, Stu.
I suppose a couple of things for me, Tom. I mean, the first one, you know, if we sort of go back and you talk about this almost like a modern World Cup, a World Cup that was certainly very different from Italian 90. And I wonder, you know, to me, it seems like almost a more polished version of the Los Angeles Olympics in 84. And I'm sure we might get into this, but I wonder if, you know, if FIFA had sort of paid attention to what had gone on in Los Angeles in 84 and sort of envisaged that sort of feeling, that sort of vibe, and sort of transferred it across into the World Cup arena.
Yeah, I think FIFA are very good at kind of looking at other things, using them as example, but never giving credit. And I think, you know, it's the most honest kind of plagiarism that you can think of, if there is such a thing. But they must have looked at other events in America, seen how they'd worked, and kind of understood themselves almost begrudgingly to an extent. If you're going to have a sporting event in the United States, it has to be bigger, brighter, more flashier, more exciting, more just larger than life in every sense than anything else. You could get away with the old-fashioned stadiums in previous tournaments because they had, you know, they had the history attached to it. In the United States, and this goes for anything, you watch a Super Bowl and the halftime show is probably more viewed on social media, probably gets more hits on social media than the actual match itself. And I think because of the situation that they were in and the place they were in, they had to kind of look at other events like the Los Angeles 1984 Olympics and just essentially, like you said, polish it up, give it a lick of paint, give it the FIFA treatment, come into town, build everything up, make everything look amazing, stay for a month and bugger off home. That's more or less what they had to do, and they pulled it off. But yeah, I think, you know, when you're in America, I'm sure the pair of you have taken a visit there at one point in your life, or know somebody that has taken a visit over there. Everything's bigger.
Yeah.
Literally to the finest degree, everything is bigger. And I felt like this World Cup not only delivered on it, but it had to be. It had to be bigger than everything else, because that's just how it is. That's just what happens when you're in America.
Yeah, it is. We had across the podcasts we've had, especially in the sort of more recent ones, you know, people have said, you know, this is the first modern World Cup because of A or B or C, and, you know, because of colour TV or because it was seen around the world or because of other things. But I think the USA one is, you know, probably, I won't say is commercial because we're all commercial, but probably it's the first mass commercial ones, and you couldn't probably go to a better place than the USA to have that sort of presentation of the tournaments. And it's very much, I guess, in the political stance of the country, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, like you said, it certainly wasn't the first commercialised one. And it certainly wasn't going to be the last one. Once FIFA got their hands into any pile of money, they were there. They were going to get themselves into it. They were going to find out how to do it, keep doing it, keep reproducing it. And that's why I keep, you know, alluding to the fact that I'd probably say this is a more influential World Cup than most people probably realise, for whatever, or certainly in this country anyway, simply because it changed the game in a lot of ways. Obviously on the pitch, new players came about and new stories were created, but off it, just trying to find the right way to put it. It's like, it was the first one where I think people can visibly remember Bill Clinton on the opening ceremony welcoming, I think he says something like, "We welcome the world to USA 94 or something along those lines. And it was like, I can't remember, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't remember a political figure doing that at the start of a World Cup.
I don't know. They may have done. I guess, you know, at these sort of times that people tend to jump on the political bandwagon. Just pick on one quick point where you mentioned that how big it was. So, I mean, I think the 94 World Cup was big for FIFA, but how big was the World Cup for America? Particularly the culture and the game growth in America, do you think?
I think what it grew because the eyes and the attention were on it. And that's always been the case for the United States. It's always been a case of if enough people are watching, it exists. If people aren't watching, it doesn't. It may as well not exist. USA 94 was essentially brought about because they wanted to show the world, you know, in no uncertain terms, what the United States was about. It was a sport they weren't familiar with on a huge scale. It wasn't anything. It wasn't the same as the NFL. It wasn't the same as the NBA. It wasn't the same as Major League Baseball, who all had stars, who all had, you know, key figures within the sport. So you look at baseball, and it's very topical at the moment, but Michael Jordan was the guy of sport in general. They didn't have that for soccer for quite a while. They didn't really... They knew about it, but it was always the other sport. That sport ain't for here, it's for Europe and South America and everything like that. It kind of brought it over, and the story is well known that USA 94, one of the reasons, one of the factors of bringing the tournament to the United States was they had to have a classified Division One league. They didn't have one at the time. They had amateur leagues, but they didn't have a professional one. That's where Major League Soccer came about. Major League Soccer was founded off the back of, well, because of USA 94. It was then launched in 1996, I believe it was. And then people became more aware of what was happening. People became more aware of the USA men's national team from that World Cup. There will be people that have fond memories of watching those games, where they were, the same way we do, I suppose would be the best way to put it. Everybody knows where they watched their first World Cup. Everybody has vivid World Cup memories, mainly from when we were children, because it's so ingrained in us. For a lot of people over there, it was their first World Cup. It was the first time they could watch a team and kind of go, yeah, you know, the USA are here, we're at the World Cup, we're competing against teams like Germany, and they're in the same place as Italy and Brazil and all these other countries. And they saw the star players that they'd heard about, so like your Romarios, your Baggios, your Mateuses, your Klinsmans, your Maradona, of course. It was the first time that they really got to be exposed to it. And I think because of the impact it had and because of the knock-on effect it had, it did prove to be a massive one for soccer in the United States. And it is, just one final thing before we move on, it is still seen as the benchmark. You know, they've reached quarterfinals. They've won gold cups, which is their regional tournament. They've reached finals of Confederations Cups. But USA 94 is probably still the team and the tournament that is seen as the benchmark, seen as the team to beat. Because everybody will know who at least one player in that team is.
Yeah. Steve? Yeah. Is it all right to just go back one step, Tom? Is that all right?
Yeah.
Because obviously when you're talking there about, you know, America and it being ready and all those things now, I mean, we've talked about this a couple of times on other podcasts where it's come up. And obviously, originally, Mexico 86, you know, had been promised to Colombia. Colombia couldn't follow through with plans to host based on the expansion of the tournament, and so it was offered out. And obviously there's this, you will know far better than I will, the sort of the mythical pitches that went to FIFA in America's sort of 2-hour 100 plus page document that was put before FIFA. And Mexico's, well, I'm not saying the back of a fag packet, but a lot shorter, a lot more abbreviated version, in and out within 10 minutes, and we're pouring champagne while America was still presenting. So obviously there was 1986, and then obviously in 94 it's given to America. I'm not saying it had to be given to America, that's not it, but in terms of those two tournaments and those two different time frames, do you think 94 was a more appropriate time for the US to get the World Cup as opposed to 86?
It was perfect. It couldn't have, I don't think it could have worked in 1986 because the football world in, well, we'll say the football world in the United States was not built and was not ready for a World Cup. They were aware of it, obviously, because everybody's aware of the World Cup, but it wasn't, excuse me, it wasn't to the size it was in 94. And I just don't think it would have worked because that's the 86. That was in the prime of, and again, I don't want to bring too many other sports into it, but that was the prime of the Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Los Angeles Celtics, Boston Celtics rivalry. And that is what sport in America was at that time period. It would have been lost. The World Cup within America itself probably would have been lost because eyes were elsewhere, attention was elsewhere. For 1994, you had Michael Jordan and you had the World Cup. That was it. There was more eyes and there was more attention. There was more opportunity to have attention on it in the World Cup more than anything. I mean, ironically, for the World Cup in 1994, it did coincide with the O.J. Simpson incident, which is probably, you know, it's probably the biggest news story in probably since like Watergate or Vietnam in America, and it happened in that time period. So just their luck. They couldn't have happened a week later or a month later. It had to happen then. But with 1994, it's like we said at the start and at the top of the show, it felt like a new time. 1986 was fit and perfect for Mexico to have it, because I always look at World Cups, and I'll use 2010 South Africa as an example. I can see that World Cup elsewhere. I can see that World Cup being played anywhere on the globe except for South Africa, because it just didn't really have an identity. Mexico 86, I felt, had an identity. I can't imagine that being anywhere else. USA 94 had an identity, and I can't imagine that being anywhere else. You couldn't even swap the two around. Even though, on the face of it, the sun shining bright on seemingly every game, and Diego Maradona being at both tournaments, two different results for him, fair to say. But I can't imagine them swapping around. It had to be at that time. And inadvertently, you know, obviously it wasn't planned from the USA's point of view to have it in 1994, but it just allowed them, with the advances in the world and in communication and technology within that short period of time, it was absolutely the perfect time for it.
Yeah, excellent.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I mean, just thinking as you were talking there, Tom, I see exactly what you're saying. It's almost that the country puts its own slant on it, and that's probably not the right way of putting it, but it imposes its own culture onto the tournament, and it becomes part of the country as much as part of the World Cup. So yeah, it's a good point. Just want to take it back. You mentioned the Irish earlier, and obviously later in 1994, in Northern Ireland, the IRA and also Protestants declared a ceasefire. Now, Northern Ireland obviously weren't at the tournament, but the Republic were. So this must have been. They must have had a sort of a carry an extra burden, shall we say, of sort of representing the Irish people in America, so of which there apparently, allegedly, there's the story goes, there's more people in the USA claiming Irish parentage than there are people in Ireland.
It was a massive tournament. It was a massive tournament for them. And a lot of, to be honest, it was, again, we talk about the perfect time. It was the perfect time for this Irish team to be at this World Cup. I don't think that this Irish team would have had the same effect it did if it was in Russia or Mexico, because they just would have been another team. I feel like with this team in this World Cup, there's just something that ties them together. And of course, the whole there's more Irish people in America than in Ireland itself might be a thing. It might be, you know, that might be true. But I also think, speaking to Tony Cascarino, we work quite closely together on the weekends, and we've done interviews away and we've travelled together, and I've always picked his brain about this World Cup, because he's played for great clubs, he's experienced great moments, but I'm always, always, always curious about this World Cup, and he absolutely loves it. He has nothing but positive things to say about the team, players like Andy Townsend, who he loves, who I unfortunately cannot think anything else other than him saying, "For me, Clive," on ITV commentary, which is unfortunate, because I'm sure he was a good commentator, but I can't remember anything he said apart from them three words. John Aldridge, another player he absolutely loves. They were the perfect group for that time. And I keep saying perfect and throwing it around like it's nothing else, like it's perfect, happens all the time. But you speak to Tony Cascarino about what the group was like. They had the perfect manager in Jack Charlton, who understood what it was like to be English in a Irish setup. They had players like Tony, Andy Townsend and John Aldridge, who I'm not going to say they weren't Irish, but they weren't stereotypical Irish. I think that's probably the nicest way to put it, because they all spoke with different... two of them were Cockneys and one was a Scouser, but they're Irish. We'll leave it at that. And they just adored their time there. They kind of... The support they got from the fans, I think, was another thing that kind of drove them on. And maybe this World Cup, they looked at it and just... I don't know. Maybe they were the hope of Britain. And I know they're not, without getting too deep into it, the Republic side of it isn't seen as British, but there would have been a lot of people who knew the players, who wanted them to do well, that had goodwill towards them. Maybe that even includes the Northern Irish, because I think this was such a likeable group of players who were so talented, who were familiar to most people watching in the United Kingdom anyway, that maybe their World Cup performance and the way they played and the way the fans treated them and how they just seemed to be full of joy during this World Cup, maybe that did have an effect on real life situations. That's a rather flippant way of saying it, but situations away from the football field. Maybe it did have an effect on it.
Yeah, Stu.
It's funny just listening to you there, Tom. Again, it's something that I'm quite interested in your take. You know, you've spoken quite eloquently about how, you know, it felt new. You know, America was all, or the USA was like a new frontier, if you like, for soccer at that time, and so everything felt like not tentative, but felt, well, look, you know, it's brand new, we don't know what to expect, let's just go. And I just wonder, you know, you mentioned, you know, passing there Bulgaria, I think of Nigeria, I think of the Irish, and I just wonder, you know, what you think as to whether that, I mean, America likes to call itself the land of the free, but I just wonder if, because of the location of where the World Cup was, because it had never been there before, because it wasn't necessarily a traditional football or soccer hotbed, if you like, for the first time, whether or not that engendered the freedom that you've just talked about there with the Irish, you know, perhaps with the Bulgarians, whether the environment, the fact that the World Cup was in the USA, the fact that it was new, actually freed up a lot of the teams, the way they played, just to embrace the occasion and the situation rather than anything else.
I think that's a great point. And it's one that, not until you started talking about it, I didn't think of it that way, because this is going to sound so kind of like movie sound over trailer guy, but it was like a new frontier for world football, going to this far and away place that doesn't even like the game. And then they get over there and people, you know, shock and horror, people like football. And I think because everybody was so happy to be there in the stands, and in a way, it's because it was such a world away from the tribalistic kind of, we're here to see our team win, we're here to scream at the opposition, and we're here to sing songs, maybe including profanity. They were the three things that pretty much were not at that World Cup. Obviously, fans went there to see their team win, but a lot of them just seemed happy to be there. And it was great. Looking at it and watching it back, just hearing people cheer enthusiastically, it was like, it did feel new, as we said. And I suppose, obviously, I can't speak on their behalf, but I can imagine for the players that probably felt refreshing, because there wasn't a media circus around them. There wasn't the whole kind of, you know, you get them stories of so and so was outside the Romania hotel at 3 a.m. setting off fireworks, because once a firework is set outside a hotel, you can't get back to sleep. There wasn't really any stories of that happening. There wasn't any real trouble. There wasn't anything along those lines. And it just felt, I can imagine from the players' point of view anyway, their shackles were let off in a way, because the expectation in the stands was not, I know what you can do, Roger Miller, why are you not doing it? They were probably just like, oh my God, he looks like he's having a great time. He's having a great time, we're having a great time, and he's dancing. Look at him. God, what's the chance of that happening? But
it's interesting to say that. I'm just sort of thinking as you were talking there, Tom, and, you know, on the surface you'd say, well, the USA isn't a football nation. You know, they have other sports. But what the USA is a massive, massively immigrant-inspired country. So, you know, and what brought this to mind was the Italy-Ireland game that was held in New Jersey. Now, I mean, they were probably the two largest immigrant populations of New Jersey. I mean, you know, the classic sort of, you know, New Jersey accent and that sort of thing. But also, you know, the people from I don't know, Spain, people from Italy, people from Europe and from South America, Mexico, all where football is important. So there might actually have been this latent audience that just hadn't been tapped into. And that just ties in with what you were saying about how the joy was that these people were seeing, you know, world stars come to the USA. And I just want to sort of ask you, I mean, you might not know anything about it, but just your sort of take on it, how important it was, how clever, how typically American financially astute it was to have the Italy-Ireland game in New Jersey.
I wish I could be carefree in my mind and say it was just the luck of the draw, but it was... So, I want to preface this. I do not know this for a fact, but I'm willing to put my house on it that they looked at that game and just went, well, you know, if it happens to be played in the New Jersey, New York area where there's loads of Italians and there's loads of Irish, then, well, so be it. You know, it just means we're going to make a lot of money. I think they made a conscious effort and they looked at that draw and they just went, yes, we know exactly where that game's going. The same way that you'd probably look at it, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there was probably a lot of games in Los Angeles that contained South American countries. And this ties into, I do mention this ever so slightly, this is the time for the shameless plug. I do mention this in my book, The Stateside Soccer. I had to get it in there somewhere. But the United States, on the face of it, and the stereotypical what we know as the United States, is not a football country. I think we spoke about this on the podcast we did about the book. It isn't a country that you would immediately associate with football. That being said, there are people and nationalities within that country that you would associate with football, whether that be Spanish, Germans, Italians, Irish, Argentinians, Brazilians, Mexicans, even to an extent, I guess, Canadians. That, I think, is why it worked. Because if it was a kind of like a Midwest, an all-white Midwest stadium that didn't know much about it, then I don't think it would have worked. But if you're going to Italy Island at Giant Stadium, which is, even back then with travel routes, quite accessible from Manhattan, from Brooklyn, from Queens, from all those kind of places where there are a lot of Italians, there are a lot of Irish, then there's going to be a lot of people there. How many people there could come from Italy and Ireland? I don't know. But how many of them people that were in that stadium were happy to see Roberto Baggio? How many people in there thought 2 years, 3 years beforehand, 4 years beforehand, that they were going to see at some point in their life. Roberto Baggio, Franco Baresi, Dennis Irwin, Tony Cascarino, I guess, to put him in with them players. How many people would have sat there and gone, yep, they'll be playing a competitive fixture in our place, in our country, in our town, in our city, in our stadium? I think, in a way, it's like when you see a children at a pre-season game or a cup game, and at a certain age, you look at cup games and you kind of go, oh, I don't care about the third round replay of the FA Cup. But to some kid who never thought they would see Alexis Sanchez or whoever, they're just so overcome with, oh my God, I get to see these players, that they're just happy and they leave happy. And I think it might be a bit redundant and flippant to leave it like this, but I think there was probably a lot of people that were just so happy to see the stars that they knew about and they'd seen at previous World Cups and whatever football they did manage to watch on American television or whatever they read about or whatever they spoke about with their other family members. They were just so happy to see them that they probably didn't care much about the result.
Yeah, Stu?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's funny, obviously, we did... The last episode we did of this was 1978 and Argentina, and it's strange how, although we're chatting in three different areas of the world and, you know, we're connected through the internet and the Wi-Fi, but yet the tone and the vibe of the two podcasts are so contrasting. I mean, obviously the content is co-contrasting, which kind of helps with that, but it just seems that sort of from 78, you know, sort of obviously we have 82 and 86, then we get to 94, and it seems like sort of this World Cup has, if ever there was an opposite World Cup to 1978 in the last episode that we did, then this is it. And I suppose a bit that you mentioned at the beginning with regards to Bill Clinton, and then obviously we looked at the military coup, and Vidal and his impact on Argentina 78, and then, you know, you talk about Bill Clinton welcoming the world to 94, and it just seems that what to me FIFA seemed to want a very well planned, a very well attended, a very corporate, a very polished, but a very, well, you mentioned it, you know, a Disney style World Cup, which is a great phrase, and it seems to me like America almost put together a blueprint of how a global event, a feel-good event, could be put on to, like you said, to maximise enjoyment. You know, there was never any air of menace or malice at any of these games. It just seemed like if you believe that sport can not heal the world, but can certainly take people's focus away from a lot of the ills that go on in the world, then this USA 94 is almost the blueprint that any country hosting a mega global sporting event, this is the blueprint for it. Like you say, even down to where are we going to place the teams, where are we going to get maximum exposure, who's going to get the most enjoyment. And I think I'm right, this is the best attended World Cup with average attendances. Tom, is that right?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware. Yeah. I mean, I'm confident that Russia didn't break that record, but because of the sheer size of the stadiums involved and the amount of people that went, I think it does hold the record. Yeah.
And it, like I say, it just seems that from the sort of the dourness of 1978 to a more traditional European Cup in 82, and then, you know, Mexico is, you know, it has that South American feel, that Latin American feel, and, you know, it's lit up by Maradona. But then you get to 94, and it just seems like the most, the single most joy, probably the most joyful World Cup, I think, that I can remember. It just seems to be the blueprint for how a global sporting event can actually make people feel good. I think it was
the first World Cup where FIFA figured it out. And when I say figured it out, I mean they figured out how to make it the world's biggest sporting event. Because I'm sure there were other World Cups where we'll take Mexico 86 for an example, or Germany 1974. Quality-wise, they were probably two World Cups that were better than USA 94, and they will be seen as that because of the players that he had on show and the teams that he had on show. It was Cruyff's World Cup, it was Maradona's World Cup, yada yada yada, everything along those lines. But you go back and watch him, and there was no advertising, there was no modern feel to it. There was, well, in 1974 there was no advertising, in 1986 there was, but 94 was kind of like an accumulation of, right, we've got the quality, no matter who comes to this tournament there will be quality, but we need to make it look like the World Cup, not just a bunch of players playing in a dark stadium in Naples, but always got history, therefore it's important. No one watches a match and goes, God, that stadium's full of history. No, they go, no, that stadium's old. That stadium's run down. They look at Giant Stadium and it's massive. They look at the Rose Bowl and it's massive. They look at RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C., and that's massive. They look at all these places that are larger than life. They are fit for the biggest tournament in the world. And it was almost like the Americans knocked on FIFA's door and just went, no. This is how you put on an event. Because, you know, even the Americans grew with their Super Bowls and they realised it was getting bigger than they had anticipated. So they started putting them in bigger stadiums. They started getting bigger acts involved. You know, you even had Diana Ross taking the penalty in the opening ceremony. Can't tell you what song she sung, because I don't know me. But I can tell you that she missed a penalty and the goal still exploded. That's how good a shot it was. But it was that whole kind of, as we said, the Disneyfication of the World Cup, and it's the blueprint for everything since. And I think you look at the Premier League in the short spell it had before 1994, and then you look at it in the years following, and it definitely took some influence on it. You look at the Champions League, and it definitely took some influence from it in how bright it's presented, in how... And I think another thing, this is one of them ones where people probably don't realise it, but in the long term, it matters. When you're walking down the street, and I'm sure you've been to Wembley Way, in the new Wembley, and whatever event's on the lamppost, they'll have a banner of whatever it is. So if it's a League Cup final, they'll have, or an FA Cup final, they have banners of the players with the logo. You know, before you even got to the stadium, you know what's there. I saw that in doing some research on USA 94, I saw some footage of, I think it would have been Los Angeles in and around that time. And it was, Los Angeles was featured heavily in it, but there was also places like the center of Chicago and Boston and everywhere like that, places where games were held. And there was banners, MasterCard-sponsored banners, promoting USA 94. There was no players on it, but the logo of the tournament was on there. So people were more aware of this. It was almost kind of like they had figured out how to advertise and promote themselves properly for two reasons. One, because that's just how Americans are, that's how American sports are. But also, they probably felt like they needed to up their game a bit, because, as we've said, it's not stereotypically a football country. People that are Italian are going to go anyway because they love football. People that are Irish, Mexican, Spanish, German, or everything like that, South Americans, they're going to go because they love the sport. They were appealing to people that were not fans in May of 1994, but were fans in July 1994. That's who they wanted to appeal to. That's who they advertised to. And they realised that they couldn't just advertise with, come and watch Roberto Baggio. Because people would have, quite rightly, that don't know it, would have turned around and gone, who? I don't know who Roberto Baggio is. But they're just like, this is it. This is what you're coming to see. You're not buying tickets to a football match, you're buying tickets to an event. This is a day out. And I think you see people talk about football is a day out now. You see family fun days at various clubs around the country. I'm not saying USA 94 directly inspired that, but that way of planning, that way of commercialization of an entire day of football, I think you could probably put that at some point to USA 94.
Yeah, that's a fair comment. Just before, I obviously want to get into the tournament itself, and, you know, because we can sort of talk about the preparation and the location and the choice of the host, et cetera, for quite a while, because politics in the USA and sport are so intrinsically linked. But just one, before we get into the games themselves, I want to ask you one quick question. So, I mean, this sort of series is about politics and football, but quite often, you know, as we've gone through the, I don't know, 40-odd or 50-odd that we've done, quite often you can sort of delete the word politics and put money instead there. So was FIFA driven to go to the USA for A, pioneering reasons, or B, financial reasons?
They will say pioneering. We will infer financial.
Agreed.
I think that's probably the clearest way to put it. They probably told themselves enough, we will shape the sport in this new country. We're going to be the ones to dominate the United States with football and soccer. We're the ones that they're going to remember. What they actually looked at was, they get how much into a stadium? How many thousands? Right. Okay. Yes, let's go there. I think that's what they looked at, you know.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, Stu?
Yeah, like I say, I think, you know, I suppose it comes back, like you said, Gary, before we get into the games and the tournaments itself, the more Tom spoken, and I started off right at the top of the podcast, not, you know, fully admitting that I probably know the least about USA 94 than any other World Cup, and I'm obviously making notes here, and it's funny that even just a little bit about that football, almost going to football became an event during USA 94. You know, it's a day out, they're marketing it as an event, and you go to, you know, certainly go to Premier League games now, or you go to football, and there are, it's something that I've never really considered before, but I suppose you trace it back to 94, and you can probably see bits and pieces, and, you know, as again Tom mentioned, you know, even at that time in England, it was that feel good factor, it was starting to build, you could feel sort of Britain was starting to become a lighter, brighter nation. But, you know, you go before 94 and there doesn't seem to really be any semblance of it. And again, you know, as you and I have said before, Gary, you know, football, culture and society, that they're so interlinked, and, you know, you can't have one without reflecting the other, and vice versa. And it does seem that although we talk about football in this country as pre-Premier League and post-Premier League, but I suppose how football is viewed as a spectator sport, you know, and is something that Tom's mentioned, is something that I've never thought about up until tonight. And it probably is. If I think long and hard about it, it probably is post 94 World Cup and pre 94 World Cup as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's something that I don't think many people realise, because the World Cup, as we said before, this particular World Cup isn't seen as fondly as others, because, as we all, you know, We live here, we know what it is. If England do well, it's a good World Cup. If England don't do well, it's not a good World Cup. Regardless of what happens elsewhere, that's the general feeling. Same with European Championships and everything like that. But I think this World Cup was so powerful to an extent where England hadn't even got there and people still enjoyed it for various reasons. They found characters in the game. They found kits they loved. They found teams they loved. They found... I've seen people that identified with places and wanted to go to places after watching this World Cup. So it was the preparation to it and the build-up to it in the long run made it a very influential World Cup down the line.
Can I just ask you one question as well, Tom? Is that all right, Gary?
Yeah, come on, yeah.
Sorry, just one question. I made a note of this right at the beginning, and I just wonder, Tom, your perspective on this. You know, we talked, you know, you mentioned at the beginning about, you know, Tony Blair, you know, sort of the rise of New Labour, you mentioned the Stone Roses, Blur and Oasis system. And like you say, in England, we seem to become so obsessed with the World Cup. So the minute England have qualified in the September, October of the previous year, and then it goes right through to that summer. Do you think, this is an aside question, I'm really sorry, but do you think that the fact that we gave more consideration to what was happening in the country because England never qualified for a World Cup. We weren't distracted, as you've mentioned there, by the nuances of how would we do, who was injured going into it. All of a sudden, because we weren't there, it's almost like we were free to appreciate other cultural elements, other artistic elements, other things that were happening in the country at that time. Because obviously we went from 90 to 98 in terms without a World Cup distraction, if you like, and so much happened in this country culturally, politically, in those sort of 8 years. I just wonder what you think about whether that failure to qualify actually allowed us to concentrate a little bit more on what was happening in our own country.
I think, obviously, you know, you will know this more than I will, because I was 3 years away from being on this earth when this World Cup happened, which I apologise if that makes anybody feel their age.
It does.
Yeah, it really does, yeah.
that's why I'm here. It's not actually to talk about World Cups, it's to make people feel different about their age.
To bring the average age down, is that it?
Oh, yeah, I am, you know, like the 16-year-old making his debut in the last 5 minutes. I'm the player that Jose Mourinho goes, I play young players, total 10 minutes. So this is just my perception of it, looking back on it. Obviously, you'll know what it was like during the time. But I think it was quite refreshing for football fans to not worry about the fitness of Carlton Palmer and just watch football and not have to worry about disliking who's in England's group or worrying about who's fit or I don't know, he plays for this team, I'm not meant to like him, but I like him because he plays for England, and then kind of going, I don't like Lothar Matthäus, why don't you like Lothar Matthäus, who does he play for? Germany, that's why. It's like, oh no, I don't have to dislike anybody now, I can like everyone. And that is, I think they kind of, because there was no ill will going into the tournament in terms of the football point of view, and I also think there's probably more of an acceptance to overseas football at that time, coming into that time anyway, because am I right in thinking that Football Italia, the Gazzetta Football Italia show, had started in and around this time on Channel 4?
Oh, it was well before that.
Yeah, because it coincided with Gascoigne going to Lazio, yeah, didn't it?
Yeah, well before that.
Yeah.
There's probably a tie-in between people watching that programme and kind of going, hang on, they're good. That Torino side, they're good. And kind of understanding that there is football outside of these shores in months that aren't in World Cups, and understanding that there are players out there who are very talented, appreciating the skill of other players, appreciating the culture of other teams. And I think 94 was a point where people had that appreciation, people had that easygoing feel and the happiness and the joyous kind of everything's bloody great period in this, you know, the mid-90s. And because England weren't there, people, like the players, could just let go. They could just enjoy it. And that's probably why people who were younger at the time and remember it, that's probably why they remember this fondly.
Yeah. Just want to sort of, as I said, sort of get into the events of the games, what happened, and I mean, actually, the things I'm going to talk about now are strictly football events, but you'll see where I'm coming from. There are two sort of, one tragic occurrence and one... Not good occurrence, shall we say. I mean, I'm thinking about, obviously, Escobar, who got actually murdered for apparently scoring their own goal in the game that meant Colombia wouldn't qualify. And the other incident is Diego Maradona and the cocaine issue. Now, I mean, obviously, I have no personal knowledge of this, but I assume cocaine isn't necessarily a performance-enhancing drug. So it was more sort of the recreational thing, but I mean, how were those two things perceived, or how do you think those two things were perceived by the Americans? I know one happened during the tour, one happened afterwards, but there is that sort of drugs link between the two events.
I think the Escobar one probably had a bigger effect, not only because it was a bit, you know, I say a bit, you know, not only because it was 10 times more tragic and because it was an issue that went beyond the sport, but there was also a lot of Colombian nationals who paid attention to the news. There was a lot of attention on the whole Pablo Escobar situation down in Colombia for many years, and the fact that it happened excuse me, the fact that it happened in an important game in the United States only hammered home just how important the situation was with Maradona and his drugs issue, with the cocaine issue. Drugs in American sport is something that I think they have a bit of a better understanding on about than we do, because they've been exposed to it, to people using drugs and being suspended because of drugs, as opposed to the drugs themselves. But to see Maradona, you know, him looking into the camera, even now, even though you know what happened, and even though you know what happened just following that, he still looks completely out of it. But yeah, we know that because we know Maradona. So people that don't know Maradona, they probably didn't think anything was up. They probably looked at his eyes and just went, God, he's a bit intense. But they probably didn't look and go, he's on something. Because people probably had a better understanding now about Maradona and his recreational side off the field, I think. But with Escobar, because of how serious it was, if I remember correctly, it was due to people were betting on the game, on the Colombia game, that he scored the own goal in. So it's one of them ones where people say he got killed because of he scored an own goal. It isn't, yes, he did, but it isn't entirely that way. Dangerous people were betting on that match, and they were betting on Colombia, and he happened to be the one that scored the own goal. He came out after the game and apologised over and over again and said, obviously I didn't mean for this to happen. It's a great shame. I apologise. I think he was team captain as well.
He was.
And then he, you know, what happened, and people kind of took it from people were betting on the game who were involved in the Pablo Escobar situation, who then lost money because of his own goal, found Andreas Escobar, killed him, then twisted into he was killed because he scored the own goal, into Escobar killed Escobar, that kind of thing. And it is very interesting, especially if you watch the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, The Two Escobars.
Yeah,
it's extremely, extremely excellent film. Yeah. Because it's a film and it sums up the situation perfectly. It wasn't so much about the sport. It was more about the situation off the field in Colombia and the situation in Colombia. And I guess programs like Narcos and on Netflix has kind of romanticized the whole Pablo Escobar situation and what was going on down there. But there was a big, big kind of tense atmosphere between America governments and Colombia, because of there was a lot of alleged, anyway, I don't know if it was ever proven, drugs coming in to America from the Escobar trade. And this kind of, because it happened in America to a Colombian player, it kind of just, that was far more important but far more poignant for the time. Because I think, yeah, we'll put it this way, it's not every day, and this might sound quite flippant and I apologise for that, it's not every day that you see a situation like Andreas Escobar at a World Cup, but any player can look into the camera with cocaine eyes and get down.
That's true, yeah, good call, yeah. Stu?
I mean, the Andreas Escobar, you know, situation. You know, we've talked, you know, for a while now about what a good job the USA did, and I'm not saying it was unexpected. I'm sure those within the corridors of FIFA and certainly those on the organising committee were fully aware and confident. But in terms of obviously what we've talked about, do you think in any way the Escobar? I appreciate before I ask this that it has nothing to do with FIFA, it has nothing to do with the organising of a World Cup, but do you think in any way the death of Escobar, Maradona aside, but the death of Escobar taints in any way the legacy of this tournament?
I would, I'm probably sure there is going to be a lot of people that disagree with this. I don't think it does. I just think it's linked to it. I think, I'm not going to compare these two situations, but it's the first example of anything that I can think of. If you see, and I'll use England because we tend to be involved in this quite a bit, if you see fan hooligans, I think we had an issue with Russia, England fans had an issue with Russian fans in Marseille during Euro 2016. That is, they are football fans. They are fighting other supposed football fans because they played each other in a football game. That's linked to football. that is something that, if people remember Euro 2016, they will remember fan hooliganism, because it ties in, you ties into it. I think with the Escobar thing, and again, people will probably disagree with me, because it didn't happen within the World Cup, and it happened when they got home. It's linked to the USA 94 World Cup, but it isn't. I don't think people tie them together. The own goal obviously happened at USA 94, but the subsequent actions happened following Colombia's exit of the tournament. So I think if it had happened, this is going to sound horrible, if it had happened within a training camp at the World Cup, and he was taken out with a hit when he was getting into the team bus or anything like that, then I think it would have. But because it happened away from the bright lights of the USA 94, I don't think it taints it as much as it could have. It will always be remembered for that. It will always be one of the things that, when people say to you, what do you remember at USA 94? It's probably in the top five things. But then at the same time, I wouldn't say that's linked in it as such, but Maradona is probably more associated, the eyes, the Maradona into the camera and the eyes is probably more associated with USA 94 than the death of Andres Escobar.
Sorry, Gary, can I just ask? Do you think that's we've talked about the US and, it being a new world, and I suppose, again, if you take those two things in isolation, and Maradona was such a global icon, and such a dominant figure in the world of football, and it was something that football fans could relate to, whereas the cartel death of an international footballer is almost so beyond the realms of what would happen in football that's why those two things are, like you say, the Maradona into the camera, but that's because it's who he was. There's always been suspicions that it was very much a football related, whereas like we say, almost the assassination of an international footballer based on something external through a cartel is almost unheard of in football, that's why they can be separated out.
It's easier to understand Maradona than the Colombian cartel, because people saw Maradona, they saw his eyes, they knew Maradona. It was an easy conclusion. Yep, this is what he's done. This is what's going to happen to him. End of conversation. With Escobar, it was a lot more complicated. It was a lot more out of this world. And obviously we know that football is quite an enclosed community, is quite an enclosed world. When something happens to somebody outside of that world to that extent, it's almost treated with safety gloves on, where people stand back and look, but they don't want to touch it. And I think that was the situation there with Escobar and the Maradona comparisons.
Yeah. Sorry, Gary.
That's fine, buddy. I just want to sort of move on to the American team, Tom, because American sporting prowess across so many different sports is almost on the nod. And obviously, the USA team that competed in this World Cup were less spectacular, shall we say. But they didn't do that badly. They got through to the knockout round and only lost 1-0 to Brazil, who obviously won the tournament in the end. How important do you think to the success of the tournament, A, and then B, to the development of the game in the USA, was the success of the USA team?
To the tournament, not that much, because I'll use it from a personal experience with the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. I didn't expect South Africa to do much because I didn't know much about them and I didn't expect much from them. So when they went out, I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. As long as the big boys are through. Because nobody really knew anything about the USA players at the time, maybe off the top of my head, they probably know about, okay, this is going to be very, very stereotypical, but Alexi Lalas, because of what he looked like, as opposed to his ability. So there probably wasn't much expected of them from outside of the country. There probably wasn't much expected from them within the country. To the importance of the tournament itself, I don't think it had too much of an impact, other than the fans were cheering them on and they were good games and good atmospheres to watch and get involved with. But in terms of the growth of the game over there at that time, they had to do well. Maybe not you know, there's no shame in losing 1-0 to Brazil, who then go on to win the World Cup. That's, for most teams, you hold your hands up and go, I'll take that. 9 times out of 10, I'll take that result. For a team like that, that were built largely on players that had been dotted around Europe because they didn't have a professional league to play in their own country, they got together, they had a very, very cool kit, which, you know, I think there's probably going to be another book released on this tournament anyway, and you can probably read a fair amount about it anyway, coming out soon. And it was important because they showed that they were quite good. And the thing with America is you can have as much heart, you can have as much soul, but if you don't win, you're not good. They got to a good stage. They did well. They did better than most people expected. They lost to the eventual world champions. So I think it was very important on that side of things for the growth of the game to carry on and just show that they can mix it up with the big boys. And then obviously subsequent World Cups did that as well, with the growth of the league. Major League Soccer over there did that as well. But again, you point any generation of soccer fans in America and they will point towards the 1994 team as the inspiration and as the team that hooked them. Because if they had gone out, 3 games played, no wins, no draws, 3 losses, without scoring a single goal, I'm 100% confident that what we see as American soccer is completely different now. Because they were able to be inspired by this group of players that really were inspired by the people that came to watch them. The Americans, as we know, are very, very enthusiastic when it comes to good old-fashioned America, you know, especially when they're not really expect much is expected of them, where they're free to cheer and they do well. That is when they got behind them. And I think the importance that it had on the country and the culture of the sport over in the country was massive.
Obviously you just mentioned there about expectation, and you know, you talked, you know, there's no professional league, they were dotted around Europe and they go out, you know, 1-0 to the eventual world champions. But in terms of going into this tournament, I mean, to me it seemed like this was such a massive sliding doors moment for soccer in the US. You know, like you say, it needed to be a successful tournament. The US team needed to do relatively well within their capabilities in order for it to hold the interest and maintain that interest going forward into the next World Cup tournament. But do you think there was the players felt the pressure? Because obviously, you know, it's the first home tournament. It's on a massive global scale, and it's okay to say there's low expectations, but when you're in it and when you're a part of that side, you know, of the home nation, it's your tournament, it's your, you know, it's your World Cup. Do you think there was actually pressure inside the US camp?
I think there was. I think there was pressure within themselves because they wanted to prove a point. And you know, you speak to a lot of US soccer correspondents and reporters and people that focus on the game, and one of the criticisms they have of the team now is that they don't work 110%. You know, it always reminds me of, you know, the Simpsons episode where they do the baseball and they've got the hypnotist and he goes, you will give 110%. They reply, it's physically impossible. One person can only give 100% of effort 100% of the time. But the US team from 94, they kind of put 110%. Because they for two reasons. They wanted to prove that they were good, because they knew they were going into a tournament where people would laugh at them and go, you're a baseball country. You're an NFL country. You're not a football country. You're not a soccer country. So they had to prove them people wrong, but they also had to prove to themselves that they, you know, we're here on merit. Yes, obviously they qualified automatically for being hosts, but they knew that the responsibility was to play well and to win. If they'd have gone out with no wins and 3 games played, the perception of them themselves would have been different. But it was a group of players that kind of thrived on the pressure, that thrived on the ability to prove people wrong, to point the finger at people and go, you didn't expect us to do anything. Here we are. We're playing Brazil. And it will always go on the record that to win the World Cup, Brazil had to go through the United States. And it was probably one of their toughest games, because it was, you know, it was a hard-working USA team. It was a USA team that knew they weren't going to outplay Brazil. So they decided to play a different way. They banned down the hatches, they made it tough for them, and that's the identity that the US men's national team had for quite a while, coming up to 20 years. Their identity was, we may not be as talented as you, we may not be as good as you, but we will put in an effort, we will put in a fight, and you will have to play to the best of your abilities to get the win. And that started with that team in the USA 94, because they felt they had to play a certain way to get a result, because they felt they had to get a result to appease multiple different people.
Yeah, good point, mate. Just want to touch on the impact with Clinton. I mean, just to sort of give you a comparison, I know when the Italian team flew out, Berlusconi, who was Prime Minister of Italy at the time, obviously he's tied up with Milan, made a big point of being the guy to wave them off and wrapping his arm around the shoulder of the Baggio and Dario Sacchi. And obviously, because the Italians got to the final, it paid off well for him. So the question we're getting at is this, is did the success of the American team, and let's face it, as you just quite rightly said, you know, they only got knocked out by the eventual champions, did that sort of give any kind of political boost to Clinton?
I wouldn't say so, because I don't think he attached himself to the players quite like Berlusconi did. Clinton was there for the opening ceremony. He was there when he needed to be, but he wasn't there 100% of the time. If you compare it to now, the particular president of 2020 would want to be everywhere. He would want to be on every camera. He would want to be doing every press conference. He would want to be the story, because that's just how some politicians are. That's how some businessmen who become politicians are as well. With Clinton, I think he understood it was good to get involved, to show, hey, look, we're open-minded. We're not mad. I was going to do a bad accent, but I'm not. I'm definitely not doing that. I realised half of it's broke. I've stopped myself. But I think he understood to get involved, show your face, say something positive, like, we welcome the world. See, I gave it a go. It was terrible. Yeah, you know, we welcome the world to the USA 94, blah, blah, blah. Aren't we great? Look at me. I look great. That kind of thing. Because he didn't attach himself so closely to it, I don't think he is a huge factor to the overriding tournament itself, like you see. You know, you mentioned Argentina 1978, and you can't talk about the tournament without the background towards it. Thankfully, the US government at the time was not in that mind of set, or not in that vein. So they kind of just let the players do the talking, they let the tournament sell itself. But Clinton, I think, he probably saw it as, this is how open-minded my America can be, because we can welcome all of these countries into our nation, and we can treat them with respect, and we can love everybody, whether they be from Nigeria, whether they be from Bulgaria, whether they be from Colombia, we respect them all at the same time equally.
Yeah, Stu?
Yeah, just, I suppose, again, as you're the expert quite clearly on this, Tom, and certainly on soccer in the US, I just wonder then about, 2026, and obviously the tournament there. Do you think, I mean, obviously it's being shared, Mexico and Canada, but do you think we'll get an even, I know this isn't the right phrase and I apologise, but do you think we'll get an even more polished version of Euro 94, or do you envisage a different tournament with a different vibe, or do you think it will just be an even more enhanced HD 4 whatever it is type event?
I hope it is. I'll start off. I hope it is like ultra 4K HD 3D glasses, LED light system.
That's it, 4K. I couldn't remember where the 4 was going. I nearly said 4D, but that wasn't right.
4D, 4K glasses that your seat move up and down, and you can smell the sweat on the players, that kind of thing. That's what I hope it is. I don't know whether it'll have the same effect, simply because in 6 years' time, or 5 years' time in the build-up to the tournament, we're going to be sitting here going, but is it going to be USA 94? Is it going to be like the World Cup in 94? It has something to compete against. if it tries to replicate it, it will be found out very quickly. It needs to find its own identity. So in 20 years' time, when we're sat here doing the podcast and I'm however old I am in my 40s when that happens, and I'm sitting here still doing bad impressions of whoever the president is at that time, we'll sit here and go, God, USA, Canada, Mexico 26, that changed the game. That changed everything for FIFA. The same way we are now with USA 94. I think, in a way, and this might be a cop-out answer, so I apologise, it's impossible to tell what it's going to be like because we don't know what the respective countries will be like at that time. If the tournament was being held this summer, I don't think it would have the same effect because the nation itself is not, obviously, excluding everything that's going on around the world. Now I'm kind of hypothetically imagining it in a healthy world where there is no viruses, where there is no stay alert, stay at home, but don't stay at home. You can just go outside with people in your household. If it was in a non-coronavirus world, I don't think we'd have the same effect because I don't think people right now are in the mood to celebrate for whatever reason. In 2026, I hope the world is different. I hope we're healthy. I hope everybody is healthy. And I hope everybody is positive. I hope everybody goes into that World Cup in Canada, in America, and in Mexico, looking to have fun, looking to embrace whoever comes over, whatever teams qualify. I hope there's a generation of fans that, in 20 years' time, they will use USA 94 the same way that I used Germany 2006 as the moment where they truly started to get into the game, where they truly started to look at it and go, yes, this is it. This is the sport for me. Will it happen? They need to find their own identity because, like we said, if they find a USA, if they try to do USA 94 in Uber 4K Ultra HD 3D LED, whatever, they'll be found out and people will realise and we won't be happy because it's not very creative. If they find their own way to do it and whatever advancements come in the world in the next 6 years, and if they find their own North America 2026 vibe to it, then maybe. But it has to be done their own way. It cannot be a BTEC version of USA 94.
Good answer, Tom. Good answer, mate. I like the 4D LED IBC. 1 through 3.
Give it 6 years, that'll be my fortune.
Yeah, okay. And if I'm sitting here doing podcast in 80 years' time, I'll be bloody delighted, mate. Tom's always a pain when we're doing these podcasts because we could go on talking for a long time, but obviously we can't even do that. We've stressed this a little bit over, but we don't care about that. We run over on a regular basis, don't we, Stu?
All the time. Yeah. I hope people expect it now.
Yeah. So we're going to finish with the same question, Tom. So this is how I'll phrase it. So you can answer this in however sort of whatever perspective you choose to take on it. So do you think that the political influences in USA 94 are greater or less than they are in more modern tournaments?
Or... That's a question half.
I got one, Stu.
You stumped me.
Well done, Gary. Good work.
You stumped me. I think this was the first one where it became an influence because you saw political figures get involved in the bidding process and in the build-up to the tournament. Excluding Argentina 78, you would see the odd political figure in and around, and you would see them putting their fingers in every pie and just, you know, it's opportunity for the cameras. You go to any opening bid kind of... We'll take it back to 2018. The England 2018 bid, when they had David Beckham, Prince William and David Cameron. I'm sure David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England at the time, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom at the time, had better things to be doing than standing around with a former Real Madrid winger and a future king to talk about a football bid, a football tournament. Because of the sheer impact that a political figure at one of these things can have, and we hear stories all the time about this political figure said this to this UEFA, this FIFA delegate, this political figure has allegedly given this house to this FIFA delegate, that kind of stuff. I think future World Cups were probably more involved politically. Certainly probably 2010 onwards. But I'd probably say, no, I don't think USA 94 was politically as involved as other World Cups, despite Clinton being involved and despite some things with Henry Kissinger in 1986, the lead up to the 1986 bid and then on to 1994. I don't think this was a politically guided, politically motivated tournament. Not in the same way that I remember the build-up of Russia 2018 being, where there was a lot of conversation about politics and political policies and everything like that, as opposed to the football. I don't think this was that was the case in this tournament.
Good answer, Matt. Good answer. Yeah, fair comment. I think I probably agree with that, yeah. Any final thoughts, Stu?
One first of all is to say thank you to Tom for giving me lots of food for thought as to how I reflect and look at USA 94. And I know, obviously, when Tom was on before, and we, you know, the book, and it, you know, even that sort of made me think about my perceptions of football in the US. But I think, you know, this is really sort of fine tuned. My interest, you know, it's things that I want to go back and have a look at, maybe read about. It's some things seem, it's almost like, ah, that makes far more sense now, or yes, I can understand where that might have come from. And it's I've always seen USA 94 as a very standalone, maybe with the exception of South Africa as well, but a very, very standalone, almost World Cups whereby it was almost awarded just because it should have been, because it was either the right thing to do or it was only fair, or, you know, perhaps, you know, the financial. So, you know, those two World Cups for me sort of stand out as, yeah, okay, but then let's get back on with a proper World Cup. And that's an awful thing to say as a football fan, but hopefully when we talk about the World Cup in South Africa, it will have the same impact as Tom's has tonight, and that is to, like I said, to actually maybe not be quite so lazy in my reflections and perceptions of USA 94 and actually go and have a look at it, go and read about it, and go and really investigate the impact, because, you know, as I said right at the beginning of the show, it's the one I know the least about, and clearly it's an ignorance on my part, for which I am very, very grateful that I was allowed to sit in tonight and have a listen.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a good, great thing after a podcast when you think, okay, you know, the guests come on and said various things that's given us a new perspective on things, on tournaments and events within tournaments that we haven't sort of picked up on before. And it just sort of, I suppose, emphasises, you know, the knowledge and the way that the successful way that the guests can engage with the subject and make it simple for us to understand as well.
Yeah, it needs to be simple for me to understand as well. Sometimes they get incredibly complicated, these podcasts. But yeah, it is testimony, obviously, to Tom and everyone else who's been on so far, that it does make me, like you say, Gary, it makes me sit and think, oh yeah, I didn't know that, or I didn't understand that, or I never thought of it like that. And it's, like I say, it's a real privilege to be able to listen to these people.
Absolutely agree, mate. So, massive thanks, Tom. Thanks for coming on and talking about USA 94. I'm sure the listeners will find it just as fascinating as Stu and myself.
Hopefully. Hopefully I was that interesting. Hopefully, you know, people listened to me and they weren't put off by my impressions.
I can't imagine they'd be put off, mate. And, you know, so thank you for coming on board and being our expert on USA 94. Next time on the Political Football or World Cup series, we'll be moving further forward and picking on another tournament and discussing the political implications and influences thereof. So thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.